Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, and I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. This week, we will be talking about the creative women's of Skid Row with Bob Boeing, who is a member of the Compassion and Response to Homelessness and Poverty Group that meet monthly at the Peace Center on the campus of USC. Bob, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you, brother. Thank you.
Let's get into our discussion about the creative women's of Skid Row. But first of all, can you tell us a little about yourself and how did you first get involved with the Skid Row community?
Well, I was born and raised in the cold part of the country back in Connecticut and went to school. Grew up in the projects. My parents were working people. My mother worked in the laundry. My father worked on the railroad. You know, we always kid about the song, "I've been working on the railroad." Well, that was the real deal with our family. But they persevered and encouraged my brother and sister and myself to go to school. So I went to, after finishing high school, ended up going to Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And I was there for a year and then transferred from Lincoln under heavy persuasion from my older and wiser brother to come to UConn. So I went to UConn and finished UConn. I was also in the service. I was in the Marine Corps. And then after getting married, came to California. I stay in touch with folks back east. My parents are both deceased, but I still have friends there. And, of course, UConn is there. And but I'm here. Mm-hmm. I'm here in California now. I've been here since, I think, about 62. Yeah,
1962. Okay. Lincoln University, is that where Booker T. Washington?
Yes, sir.
Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. Historical school. Now, how did you first get involved with the Skid Row community?
Well, my first job in L.A. was working with an organization called the BPA. A lot of folks aren't familiar with that, but at that time, that was the Bureau of Public Assistance. It has subsequently become DPSS. I worked at this, what we used to call it the Pink Plantation on Adams and Grand. The building is still there. It's not pink anymore. And I was a social worker. And my first social work assignment was working with what we called single unattached men. And although I had driven through Skid Row, because I just like getting around town anyway, I never worked in Skid Row. But my first social work assignment was what we called an intake worker. That is, I interview single unattached men. And the reason why I became more familiar with downtown is because I had to verify that they did, in fact, live where they said they lived. And they were living in, you know, some of them were in very inexpensive, rundown hotels and the SROs and whatnot. So I had a lot of contact with the guys. At that juncture, no contact whatsoever with the women that, mm-hmm. that lived in Skid Row. And then subsequent to that assignment with the single unattached men, I had what we call a family file. That is, women, they weren't in Skid Row. They were in South Central L.A. primarily, but women with raising children on their own. That was, in those days, called ANC. That was Aid to Needy Children, and it subsequently was relabeled as AFDC, mm-hmm. Aid to Families with Dependent Children. So I was a social worker dealing with families, you know, families, like I said, primarily, almost exclusively women, mm-hmm. with their minor children.
Mm-hmm. Looking back now, what do you see as the major difference between how you saw Skid Row then and now?
Wow, good question. I think the biggest difference is it is infinitely more crowded. Mm-hmm. There are a lot more people on the streets, literally. And the second major difference is families. I'm telling you, you know, my memory is not what it used to be, but I don't remember seeing as many women and most certainly no children out on the street. And now, of course, there are women and children whole families that are on the street. So that's the biggest difference. It's more crowded, and the presence of families. That's the big difference.
Okay.
Now, that's a sad difference, I might say.
Yes, it is. Now, how did you get involved with the Downtown Women's Center?
Well, while I was working for the county, and I worked for the county for 30 years, while I was working for the county, I had one of my assignments. My job was what we call the Management and Staff Development Division. I was the chief of that, and that was involved setting up training programs for administrative people within the Department of Health Services. And the reason why that's significant is because the county had money in those days, and I went back to school as a middle manager. And so I went back and got a graduate degree from University of Redlands. I was going to school at a hotel out near LAX. And so as a result of that, I ended up teaching with my graduate degree. So I initially taught at USC in the School of Public Administration, taught there for a couple of years. And then I started teaching for the Drew School, which was the academic arm of Martin Luther King Hospital. I worked at King Hospital also. Mm-hmm. I didn't even mention that as part of my county career, but I worked for Department of Health Services. After leaving the welfare department, I started working with the health department. I worked at King Hospital while the hospital was being built, and we were working in trailers on Compton and 120th Street. At any rate, went back to school and started teaching, and taught at USC, as I mentioned, and also met a guy who was at that time heading the management department the management department at Antioch University. So I started teaching at Antioch as a result of my contact with him. And one of the students that I met during that period of time at Antioch said, "Bob Bowen, I got a job for you." And so she literally talked me into coming downtown to the Downtown Women's Center. At that time, they were on Los Angeles Street. I think it was 325 Los Angeles Street. And they housed about 40 women. I know I'm compressing time a lot, but that was 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. I've been involved with the Downtown Women's Center for about 13 years. And we had a group called Striving Angels. And what the Striving Angels did was, there was a bunch of folks who, some were working, some were retired. We'd come down on the last Sunday of each month, and we'd prepare lunch for the women. So we'd either bring we all brought things that were already prepared, or in my case, I had assignment of bringing cranberry juice, and I got the nickname of the juice man. Here comes Bob, the juice man. So I've been doing it, since that time. And then they moved over to their present facility, which is just a beautiful place. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can probably talk about that.
Okay. At this time, I'm going to have Ms. Earlene Anthony read something about the Downtown Women's Center so our listening audience would know a little bit about the organization.
The Downtown Women's Center. These are just some of the service that they provide. Case management, breakfast, 7:45 to 8:45 a.m. Lunch is served at 12 noon. The doors are locked from 12 to 1 p.m. Afternoon snacks, 2:45 to 3:15 p.m. They have showers, day beds, phone and computer access, mail service, job search and job training workshop, peer support group counseling, help applying for benefits such as food stamps and GR, enrichment activities and outings such as art, music, drama, and poetry, health education workshop, health clinics every Monday, long-term housing for women with mental and physical health issues. And they're located at 442 South San Pedro Street. That's near the corner of 5th and San Pedro. And their service are Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 4 p.m., Saturdays and Sunday, 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. And you can call the daycare 213-613-0761, and you will get the Senior Day Center manager, who is Faye Brown.
Okay. And then who runs the computer center, the other young?
Patricia Everett, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Thank you. Now, back to Bob. How can you tell us about the photography program you started at the Downtown Women's Center, Project Tim? I'll let you explain that.
Sure, Melvin. I'd be happy to. I'm retired now, and so I have an opportunity to pursue all those unfulfilled activities that I thought about and dreamed about earlier during my working years. And my two... the two that are on the top of my list are writing and photography. And I thought at one time that I'd like whatever skills or gifts, if you will, or blessings that I have, I'd like to share it with other people. And so in my involvement with I call them the ladies, the ladies at the Downtown Women's Center. And we can talk about the distinction as far as I'm concerned later. But I thought that I would like to give something to the ladies over and above pouring juice. And so what happened was I thought about some way of teaching them some of the basic elements of photography and then some basic writing skills too. And here's where it gets a little bit weird. I happened to mention that project at Compassionate Response to Homelessness at one of the meetings. And there was a woman there who was a part of that group. Her name was Jill. And Jill, I don't remember Jill's last name, but she worked with the St. Francis Center. And I think it was maybe not more than 2 or 3 days after I had mentioned that. That was the first organization I even thought about talking about the photography project that I had in mind. She gives me a call and says, you won't believe what happened. And so I said, what's up? She said, somebody left a box of cameras on the front door of the St. Francis Center, and there's no information on it. It just has your name in it. That it just has your name, Bob Bowen. And I said, I'm on my way. And I got in my car and went down. She said she had no idea. She said she had not discussed it with anyone. And so I'm just saying that was a blessing, and I'm not going to question that. I don't question that. So at any rate, I took those cameras, and they were all disposable. Kodak makes them, and there are a couple other companies that make them. And I discussed with Pat at that time about wanting to do this workshop. Well, Pat subsequently was ill or something, so she wasn't able to work with me. It was another young lady down there named Nicole, who has been my contact person at the center. And basically what happened was I made an announcement one time downstairs in the day, what they call the day center. And I said, anybody interested in photography and doing some, writing, meet with me. And I mentioned the day and whatnot. And I think the first time around, about six ladies showed up, gave them all cameras. And I named the project, what I was going to do with them, Project Tim. And the letters T-I-M meant this is me, and this is me with an exclamation point, not any kind of apologetic, oh, I think this is me. No, this is me. Okay. And they all resonated around the idea of having this, and the significance of the name is that I told the ladies, I want you to go out and take a picture of anything you want to, but I want it to reflect who you are as a human being. I didn't give them any, philosophy about what it means to make a philosophical statement about who you are and all that kind of stuff. Nothing academic. This was straightforward. Take a picture of something that reflects who you are as a human being. And so in some cases, they had another person take their picture, which was fine. And then the women, there was a combination of women, like I said, there were six. And I think, as I recall, and that was a couple of years ago, like three lived at the center and three lived elsewhere in the Skid Row area. And they took those pictures and brought the cameras back to me, and they talked about the pictures. I hadn't seen them at that point, but they just generally talked about what the experience was like. And so I took the cameras and went to Sammy's camera in Culver City and told them, I said, who I was a volunteer at the Downtown Women's Center in Skid Row, blah, blah, blah. The reason why that conversation was important is because they gave me a discount, you know, so that makes them look good too, of course. So I brought all the pictures back to the women. They picked out what they considered to be their best picture. Just as one example, they didn't all take them of people. One woman I remember took a picture of a rocking chair, empty rocking chair. She said that when she sits in the rocking chair, all of her troubles just kind of melt away because she's able to sit in the rocking chair, rock slowly, close her eyes, and, you know, it's like therapy for her. Other women took pictures of flowers, and which happens to be one of my personal favorite subjects, to take pictures of flowers. I love flowers. Another woman, I recall, has a vision of herself going to Hollywood. So she got on the bus that goes to Hollywood and was taking pictures of all the things that she'd see on the way. And then she got there and took a picture of a theater, and she said, one day I'm going to be on stage in that theater, you know. Mm. So I'm saying all of those kinds, and there were a lot of other examples too. But when they gave me, they came back, discussed the pictures, and then I had them blown up to 8x10, put them on a big display board. And so then we had a display at the Women's Center so other women could see what these women had done. I took each individual woman's picture. So she had the picture that she had taken. Then I had a picture of her next to that. And then they had a little comment underneath. I just, as I was sharing with you earlier, Melvin, I just finished the fourth series in that. This last time around, 15 women signed up. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I found out is things happen to people, you know. We set up a regular schedule of meeting every Friday, but some women move, some women run into personal difficulties and whatnot. I never challenge or question what happens. If you come, I'm more than happy to see you. When you don't show up, you know, I hope whatever you're working on or working with works out to your advantage. But I don't, you know, I'm not a social worker anymore.
Yeah.
I'm a friend. I'm a volunteer. I'm a helper, if you will. So it's been a groove for me. I have learned a lot about myself. Mm-hmm. I learned, although it's hard to tell tonight, I learned how to keep my mouth shut. I learned how to listen. And I've grown as a person. I've grown tremendously. And I'm eternally grateful to the ladies at that center because of that. Mm-hmm. So the photo project, we just wound down. What will happen next is I will make up some graduation certificates for them. We'll have a little mini ceremony in the day center. And then I will give them as a gift a couple of more cameras. That's what I have done because I got almost 100 cameras when I got that box of cameras. So giving them away is I enjoy giving them away.
Well, let me ask you this, Bob. How do the photography program fits into the concept of recovery? I think you was telling me a little about it when you was explaining the reaction of a lot of the women.
Yeah,
well, what are your thoughts on
that? This may sound a little strange, but I happen to believe everybody's in recovery. That's just the personal. Everybody's been through something. And I think what happens in this country, I don't know what happens in other places, is that we see recovery, we usually think of it in terms of drugs and alcohol, you know, and a person says they're in recovery. In many cases, they're in a program or they've been through a program. But on a wider scale, everybody that I've ever known has had something happen in their life, and they're recovering from that. There could be the death of a loved one. Mm-hmm. It could be even a loss of a pet, all right? And so I'm saying is that the women the ladies that I work with, yes, some of them are in formal recovery programs, but I generalize it. I go beyond that. Mm-hmm. And by saying that and feeling that way, it makes my relationship with them so much easier, so much better. The term that I like to use is discovery. Mm. Because when we recover, we in some ways revisit an earlier state of our life. We recover it. We kind of go back to it without the problems. When we discover, we acknowledge that something happens, but we're looking like we're looking at what's ahead of me.
Mm-hmm. Right? Moving forward.
Yeah, moving forward. Moving forward. The word re means go back. To return means to, to re whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see my relationship with the ladies there as one of discovery. I like to introduce ideas and thoughts and opportunities for them so that they can discover part of themselves that they hadn't paid much attention to.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to worry about, well, they don't have to get locked into, you know, a formalized way of getting over some bad times.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's, and I find that by interacting with them in that way, it opens up all kinds of possibilities. It really, really does. They're parts of themselves, their skills that they have revealed that they hadn't even given any thought to before. And I'm finding it true for me, too, you know, that there are things about my relationship with people that I never even gave any thought to before. So I look at it not so much. I don't dismiss the concept of recovery, but that's not my emphasis. My emphasis in working with them as a volunteer is discovery, the next mm-hmm. chapter in your life, the next good thing that's waiting out there for you to grasp onto.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Have you discovered any outstanding talents that just have a natural feeling?
They're all outstanding.
Yeah,
I really have, and it's been really, really, really good. I found there are women there that write extremely well. There are women with a business sense. Let me just pick up on that one for a minute. One of the things that the Downtown Women's Center did, I don't know if they're still doing it now, but they did in the past, they took a group of women in a van out to Pepperdine. And the women took some basic business skills courses so that if they were to ever, you know, become independent entrepreneurs, they knew how to set up a business plan. They knew how to take care of a budget. They knew how to supervise people and that sort of thing. So there are a couple women that they're still there, but they have it in their mind that they're going to be business people. There are other women that I've gotten to know who sing, and though there are some with acting skills, there are some with just ordinary, outstanding, beautiful, loving people skills. There are some that should be professional counselors, because they're better than some of the dudes and ladies that I know in yeah. professional counseling, because they're not judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
They're not judgmental. You know, it's kind of like, I've been there, done that kind of thing, and I'm not going to get in your way, and I'm not going to jam you for what you may be going through.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go down the whole list of skills and whatnot. There are some that are outstanding cooks. You know, there are some that know floral arrangement. I mean, you name it, and the ladies, there are ladies in Skid Row in general and at the Downtown Women's Center in particular that mm-hmm. know how to do it
mm-hmm.
and do
okay.
well.
Okay, I'm going to ask you one more question before we take our community calendar break. And it's also a question that I want to open up for the round table later on. Do you think that most of the women that end up on Skid Row, is it related to domestic violence?
Well, I'm going to answer your question this way. I'd be reluctant to say what's true for most of the ladies on Skid Row. I've never done a formal survey, and I've never even with the handful of ladies that I interact with, I never asked them what brought them to Skid Row.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, when as we get to know each other and trust each other more, some of them will voluntarily go into what has happened in their past. I don't keep notes on that sort of thing, so I honestly, you know, cannot say. I know that some pretty, excuse the expression, funky stuff has yeah. happened to a lot of them, but statistics wise, I couldn't say.
Okay. Right. We'll open it up for the round table,
sure.
get some more input on that. Let's take a break for our community calendar, and then we'll come back with our special guest, Mr. Bob Bowen.
This is the community calendar for the month of February. The Veterans Community Theater Workshop is being held every Tuesday from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. It's free to veterans as well as non-veterans. The workshop participants are currently working on writing their own individual stage play. The location is the Vortex, 2341 West Olympic Boulevard. This is near the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic. The Metro bus number 60 and 66 stop right near or close to the corner. If you're interested in the workshop or for more information, you can contact 213-908-6587. Thursday, February the 14th at 10 a.m., the Compassionate Response to Homelessness and Poverty Group will be meeting at the United University Church Peace Center on the campus of USC. The location is 817 West 34th Street. This is at the corner of Jefferson and Hoover. And all are welcome to attend. For more information, you can call 213-748-0209, extension 13. And on Sunday, February the 17th at 6 p.m., the Women as a Force of Revolution will be having classes, and all the discussions will take place at the Echo Park United Methodist Church at 1226 North Alvarado Boulevard, Los Angeles. This is north of Sunset Boulevard at the side basement door. For more information, call 323-363-4592 or email ARISE@newsandletters.org. And on the website, www.newsandletters.org. And on Sunday, February the 24th, from 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m., the Spiritual Youth, ICUJP, the United University Church, and Drama Stage Qumran presents a discussion on an interfaith gathering on the culture of torture. There will be special guest speakers, special performances, food and drink will also be served. This is a free event, and all are welcome to attend. The location is the United University Church, 817 West 34th Street. This is at the corner of Jefferson and Hoover. For more information, you can call 818-605-7188. Upcoming guests on the Qumran Report, Monday, February the 18th, will be Karen Chappelle, she's the new director at the Roby Theater Company. And the discussion will be Paul Robeson and the Roby Theater Company. If you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Earlene Anthony. And the call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now back to our host.
Okay, thank you, Miss Earlene Anthony. Now we're back with our special in-studio guest, Mr. Bob Bourne, for our roundtable discussion. And also joining us would be Ms. Andrea Ross, Kay Usumi, and Ms. Earlene Anthony. Before we get into our tape, I'd like to ask you, Bob, you had mentioned earlier about you like to refer to the women as ladies. Can you talk about that a little while?
Yeah. And this is just a Bob Bowen thing. Women is a generic or gender term, a biological term. And it's an appropriate term. I'm not going to argue that. But it doesn't call for anything special on the part of those who interact with them. When we say ladies, it means that there's a social relationship between them, between a man and a male and a female. And that, the heart of that is one of respect, that one has to be respectful. And I think it's something that we just lose or forget about. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, old school, long time ago, my mother insisted that my brother and I, you know, interact with women who were older than us as ladies. And so we didn't curse around them, and we didn't tell our little old funny jokes and stories and stuff that dudes are supposed to keep under wraps or just share with other dudes. We were expected to be respectful. And so that meant all females with whom we came into contact, all women with whom we came into contact, we were expected to treat them as ladies. So other women in the community, in the housing project, were like embodiments of our mother, you know, because to disrespect any of them was the same as disrespecting your mother.
Great point.
And here's the heavy duty part. Your mother would find out.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, she'd find out before you got home. And there's no trying to, you know, come up with an excuse, because the relationship between the ladies was that they weren't going to tell a lie. I mean, if you did something that you weren't supposed to do, they're going to call your mother. Mm-hmm. And so that's why. And so I find even now, as many decades removed from those earlier days, that if I have the idea that the women, the females with whom I interact are ladies, then I got to act right. Mm-hmm. I just have to. Now, I fall down on that every now and then. You know, I do things that, or say things in their presence that I probably shouldn't. But it's almost always on my mind.
Well, let me ask you this, Bob, because we come up from the same generation. And I remember when we used to have to say, yes, sir, and yes, ma'am, to grown adults. How did we lose that? You know, the young generation that referred to women's as, you know, all kind of bad names and stuff. What happened?
Are we going to be here till midnight? I mean, Melvin, I would like to talk about this at length later, but I'll just give you a thumbnail from my perspective. I think that. Well, I let me speak about my growing up in my own family. We didn't have a television set until, as I recall, we were in junior high school, and that was a black and white set. And then we had a big magnifying glass in front of it to make the picture big. Mm-hmm. And there was nowhere near the kind of stuff on TV that there is now. There were no computers. When we said the word compute, we meant count. We didn't, we didn't have an R, and a computer was a person who counted, the regular movies, we went to the movies. There's no comparison between the images to which we were exposed then and the kind of garbage that's out there now. So I think what's happened is that young people and older people are being exposed to what I call madness. There's no filter, if you will. There's no filter for that. It all comes through. And with nobody around saying to young people, that's not cool, or that here's something you can wait for till later in life, then it all, that becomes their culture. That becomes it's reflected in the music. It's reflected in the writing. It's reflected in the way they wear their clothes, or the way they don't wear their clothes, or how high their pants are, or how low they are, or whatever. And all of that stuff, it's a cultural statement about the way things are now, but matching that against what the way things were, man, this is bad shape. Now, I also want to say this, that I really do understand the struggle of people who try to correct that. I have 5 adult children, and I have 12 grandchildren, and I know that it's not easy, but I find joy in the fact that they know how to be good parents. And despite the fact that there's some stuff that they just cannot keep away from their kids, because when the kids go to school, or everybody's got a little whatever they call those little
hand things.
So they get the exposure. But the fact that they're getting good parenting, I don't worry.
Mm-hmm. Great point. Okay, let me open up the roundtable discussion with the question that I asked earlier. Do you think that most of the women that end up on skid row is related to domestic violence? Anybody want to pick up on that? Your thoughts on that, Andrea?
Well, I would say that there are many women that do end up on skid row due to domestic violence. I can speak personally to that. And it was a personal choice for me to emancipate myself from a domestically violent relationship of over 2.5 decades. And when you finally have enough and you have enough, sometimes it takes you ending up on Skid Row. Some of us emancipate ourselves from Skid Row and elevate, which I was fortunate enough to do, and others do not. But it takes a mindset, and it takes a culture around you to assist you. It's not something that you can easily achieve on your own. You need help, projects, community activism, education, you know, a hand out not and a hand up in order to elevate yourself out of those circumstances. And I was fortunate enough to receive those services, and there are many that do not make it, but I pray God that they do, and I was fortunate.
Okay. How about you, Arlene?
When I was in Skid Row, it wasn't for domestic violence, but I met a lot of women that had domestic violence issues, and I learned from them that they are in such a delicate state that you can't approach them in just, say, a normal everyday walk of life. You have to wait many times for them to come to you.
Exactly.
And I learned this from many of the women. You don't question them a lot of times about things that they do. They may do things that seem strange to you, but this is how they're coping with things. Because I came in contact with a lot of them living at the Union Rescue Mission. And I remember this one incident, because I chaplain had given me the job of getting up early in the morning, cleaning the floors, making the beds and whatever. And I was really disgusted with her giving me this chore. I didn't want to get up earlier than 5 o'clock in the morning to take care of all of this. But anyway, this is what I did. And I learned a great lesson from this, because some of the women I came in contact with, it was too much for them to even make their beds at times. It was just too much. They would get up and they would just leave their bed. If you asked them to make it, it was just, you know, another burden added to them. And it was just too much, you know, to ask. They couldn't meet that need. So you would just have to, I say, wait for the women to come and open up to you, because they're in a whole different situation, a whole different surroundings than most people are been in with domestic violence.
Okay. Okay, you want to say anything about that?
Well, could I? I'm with News and Letters Committee, a Marxist humanist organization. I just want to say something that Marx wrote. I'll try to make it brief. He said that man's relation to man is based on man's relation to woman. By that, he meant man's domination over man, or man's repression over other men, are based on man's domination over woman. So basically, the women have to become free if all men are going to become free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, good point. Yeah. Before we get to our next question, I want to ask you about the funding for the project, for the photography project.
Oh, well, we have a little light. First of all, it's very, very, very small. The cameras are free.
Mm-hmm.
The Women's Center allocates about somewhere between $75 to $100 for the whole project, and we usually don't even spend all that. So it's minimal. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that I'm a member of St. John's Episcopal Church. I've been there 40 years. They're down on Adams and Flower. And I'm a member of the men's club. And so when the project launched, I don't know if it was last year. I think it was last year, maybe it was the year before, I lose track. I asked the dudes, I said, how about writing a check? And they did. They wrote a check. Because in addition to processing the film and blowing up the pictures, I also buy a little album for the women. They're very inexpensive, like $4 a piece. But it's something that they can use to put their pictures in. Mm-hmm. So costs are just, you know, it has never been a problem. And like I said, the Women's Center itself has been very responsive to, you know, to my requests. And the requests have been minimal. Mm-hmm.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. Okay, let's just say thank you, Bob. Let's just, what I want to do now, this is Black History Month. We're going to come back to our roundtable discussion. But in honor of Black History Month on the Qumran Report, the next two shows on February the 18th and February the 25th, we will be doing a Black History Moment focusing in on important individuals that have contributed to Black history. Tonight, we will focus in on the two wives of Marcus Garvey, Amy Jock Garvey and Amy Ashwood Garvey. Also, a short reading from the play Catch the Tiger. The Tiger was the code name given to Marcus Garvey by J. Edgar Hoover. Mm-hmm. Earlene Anthony would give us, Earlene Anthony and Andrea Ross first, would give us some information about the two wives of Marcus Garvey, starting off with Amy Jock Garvey.
Good evening, everyone. Amy Jocks Garvey, born December 31st, 1895, and she died July 25th of 1973, was the second wife of Marcus Garvey and a journalist and activist in her own right. She was born to George Samuel and Charlotte Henrietta Nee South Jocks in Kingston, Jamaica. Amy Jocks Garvey was a pioneering journalist and activist. She came to New York in 1917 and soon after became involved with publishing of the Negro World newspaper in Harlem from its inception in August of 1918. There were many contradictions and details surrounding Amy and Marcus's courtship. Many historians are confused about whether or not the two were having an affair. On one hand, Marcus's first wife, Amy Ashwood, claimed that the two were seeing each other behind her back. She speaks of infidelity and mistrust when describing the pain and humiliation that she felt. On the other hand, Marcus and Amy claim to have had no contact prior to the divorce of his first wife. The two claim to have a mutual relationship for one another, but they say that their contact was when she allegedly discovered that Amy and Marcus were living together. Amy alleges that any romantic contact that the two had began strictly after his divorce to Ashwood. Marcus divorced Ashwood while she was abroad in England in June of 1922. He had the divorce approved in Kansas City without her knowledge. A month later, on July 27th of 1922, Marcus married Amy in Baltimore. Ashwood felt betrayed by her friend N. Jocks, who said they to have been Ashwood's chief bridesmaid in her wedding to Garvey. She attempted to have the second marriage annulled upon returning from filing a suit to deny the validity of her divorce to Garvey. In this later, Amy Jocks Garvey was named the correspondent. The effort to have the divorce nullified failed, leaving Amy Jocks Garvey as Garvey's legitimate wife. Unfortunately, this whole debacle led to the severance of the long-time relationship. And that is the story of Amy Jocks Garvey.
Amy Ashwood Garvey. From January 10th, 1897 to May 11th, 1969, was a Jamaican Pan-Africanist activist and the first wife of Marcus Garvey. She was born in Port Antonio, Jamaica. She spent years living in Panama As a child, she was told by her grandmother that she was of the Ashanti descent. She returned to Jamaica as a teen and attended Westwood High School in Trelawney, where she met Marcus Garvey, with whom she formed the United Negro Improvement Association, known as the UNIA, in 1914. She organized the women's section of the UNIA, and in 1918, she moved to the United States, where she worked as Garvey's aide and as secretary of the UNIA New York branch. She and Garvey married on December 25th, 1919, but the marriage quickly broke down, ending in divorce in 1922. There following lawsuits and countersuits for annulment, divorce, alimony, and bigamy. Garvey divorced Ashwood in Missouri in 1922 and quickly married Amy Jock Ashwood, former roommate and maid of honor. Marcus Garvey accused Ashwood of infidelity, theft, alcoholism, and laziness. Amy Ashwood reportedly never accepted the divorce and contended to the end of her days that she was the real Marcus Garvey.
Okay. Now, at this time, we're going to read a little short section from the play, Catch the Tiger, dealing with Marcus Garvey. I would read the part of Agent James Amos, who was one of the, he was a detective in New York that headed up the investigation for J. Edgar Hoover. He was an African-American detective. And Miss Earlene Anthony would read the part of Amy Ashwood Garvey. And this is a meeting, an interview that they had at a bar in Harlem. Thank you for meeting me here on such a short notice. I know that you are a very busy lady.
Is that why you call me down here?
No, that's not why I call you down here. I call you down here to ask for your help in a case that we're working on.
What kind of case?
We are in the process of gathering information that might help us in our investigation of Marcus Garvey.
So, what does that have to do with me?
As I was saying, we are in the process of gathering information that might help us in the investigation of Marcus Garvey.
What make you think I'll help you?
Well, I know that you are a businesswoman and that you're very ambitious.
Who told you that?
I got my sources. And I also know that you want to cut ties with the UNIA and the whole nasty Garvey business.
What do you mean, nasty Garvey business?
I mean the failure of your marriage, how Amy Jock misled and deceived you into believing that she was your friend. Some kind of friend, huh? You bring her over here and train her in the movement to take your place as secretary when you marry Garvey? I bet you never thought she would take your place in this heart also. You know something? Life is full of little surprises.
You bastard.
Oh, excuse me?
You heard what I said?
Look, I'm just doing my job.
Your job. That's what all you guys say, your job.
My job is to bring this con man down.
Con man?
That's right, con man.
Is that what you think Marcus Garvey is? Let me tell you something, Agent Amos. I know what Marcus Garvey is, and he's no con man. Why don't you ask your boss, Mr. Hoover, if he think Marcus Garvey is a con man? You're afraid of Marcus Garvey for the same reason Mr. Hoover is afraid of him.
And what reason is that?
His words. You are afraid of his words. You know that his words has the power to move people, to organize people. You're just like a lot of these so-called Negro leaders in this country. You're afraid of Marcus Garvey because he has a program to help our people. Now you guys try to make him appear as a clown. Marcus Garvey is nobody's clown. He loves the UNIA. More than he ever did me. All he wanted to do is help his race, our race, like the white man helps their race.
Marcus Garvey is a cancer to race relations.
Why? Because he's telling the truth?
Whose truth? Your truth, my truth, or the truth? Marcus Garvey is only interested in his truth, and that's why he's got to go. And one thing is for sure, we're going to get rid of Marcus Garvey.
You people have already tried and tried to get rid of Marcus Garvey. But he's still here. Like when you sent that fool George Tyler to shoot Marcus. 3 shots, 2 hit and 1 miss. One creased his head and the other one hit him in the leg. But you people still couldn't get rid of Marcus Garvey. Everybody know that George Tyler was hired to kill Marcus Garvey. That's why he died in custody before he could be brought to trial. How do you tame a tiger, Agent Amos?
How do I tame what?
A tiger. How do you tame a tiger? That's what you guys call Marcus, right? A tiger? How do mere men tame a tiger? You don't. You either cage it or you kill it. But if you cage that old tiger, woe for you when you let the tiger out of his cage.
Believe me, when we cage this tiger, there would be no escape.
So say you, Agent Amos, so say you.
You think this is some kind of game, don't you?
Well, we all like to play little games sometimes.
This is no game. This is serious business.
Your business are the government's.
Let me warn you about something. It's all the same with me. This man, Marcus Garvey, is going all the way down and all the way out, and there's nothing you or I can do to stop it.
So say you.
So say J. Edgar Hoover.
And what's so special about your Mr. Hoover?
You know what they say about Mr. Hoover? They say Mr. Hoover always gets his man.
That's very colorful.
Mr. Hoover is a very determined man. So don't get yourself caught up in a crossfire between Marcus Garvey and J. Edgar Hoover. I don't want to see you get hurt.
Are you worried about my safety, Agent Amos?
I want you to understand what the reality of the situation is.
I'm not afraid of you, Agent Amos.
Afraid? I don't want you to be afraid of me.
Good. Because you're just a message boy for Mr. Hoover, and I got a message for him.
What's the message?
Tell him don't send a boy to do a man's job.
I'll relay your concerns.
You do that. Is that all, Agent Amos?
That's all for now.
The pleasure's all yours.
Okay. Since Earlene and Anthony reading the part of Amy Ashwood God. Before we move back into our roundtable discussion, I'd like to get some comments from Ms. Earlene Anthony and Andrea about the two Garveys.
Since I was the first wife, I did perhaps feel a little betrayed after I bring my best friend over and introduce her to the movement and train her in being an assistant secretarial work and so on. I'm not just sure if things was going on behind my back or they were both up front telling me the truth about everything. I want to believe that they were up front telling me the truth. I don't want to believe they was catting around.
Andrea.
Well, it's hard to say about that one. Coming from a woman's perspective, I would just say that's the nature of the beast. You just come to expect that when you're dealing with men. In general and specifically with men of quote-unquote power, so to speak. So that comes with the territory. But as evidenced by the Amy number one, she was quite adamant about believing how she believed. So one can never know, but if I had been a fly on the wall, oh, my goodness, I can only imagine what that conversation would have been.
All right. Okay. Let's get back into one more question I'd like to throw out for the round table as we wind down. How can we get the outside community more involved with the Skid Row community, especially as it relates to women?
Well, I'll jump on that quickly. I would hope that programs like this can give people an insight into some of the very, very positive things that are happening in Skid Row. I think that all of us owe it to our colleagues, our family, our friends, to know that Skid Row is a part of the real world. And this idea as of it being a dumping ground is a disastrously dangerous and incorrect perception of what goes on. There are some phenomenal things that happen, not only in the Women's Center, but I also have some had involvement with the Union Rescue Mission, with the Midnight Mission. I take clothing down to both places, and I think that people need to go downtown to some of these agencies and organizations and see for themselves what it's all about. Uh-huh. I think they'll come away enlightened, rewarded, and dedicated.
Uh-huh. Wonderful. Andrea, you want to say something about that?
Yes, I do. We as a community, individually and collectively, need to reach out and be a part and participate in the emancipation and reclaiming of the lives of some people that have been displaced by no circumstances sometimes of their own. And it takes more than just one or two people to end this gold in the positive manner. Mr. Bob Bowen to my left is a great individual. He is lending to the cause, and we need to all take up the mantle that he has chosen to take up.
Okay. Kay, what do you think about how to get more outside people involved with the Skid Row community, especially as it relates to women?
Well, I don't know, but as it relates to women, people have a wrong perception of homeless people. They don't see them as human beings.
True.
And a lot of them, just by their life experience, have a tremendous amount more experience than somebody that's well sheltered. They have learned a lot. And I think people needs to quit listening to the mainstream media and about all the negative aspects of Skid Row somehow. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how people will come down.
Yeah. Okay, but it's a great event that's coming up on February the 21st and 22nd as a fundraiser. Ms. Earlene Anton is going to tell us about it.
Save the Date, Downtown Women Action Coalition present the Majana Monologue, V-Day, written by Eve Ensler. The monologues featured in this play relates to love, sex, and other mysteries, struggle, and triumph of women. All proceeds go to the Downtown Women Action Coalition, DWAC. DWAC's vision is to establish a collective voice that communicates the strength and power of women in the downtown Los Angeles community. The dates are Thursday, February the 21st, Friday, February 22nd. The doors open at 6:30. The show starts at 7. The location is the Vortex Theater, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard. This is right at the corner of Olympic and Santa Fe. Also, the bus number 60 and 66 stops right at or near the corner. General admission is $25. Low-income residents, $10. Group of five or $50. To RSVP, please contact Becky D. at cangress.org.
Okay. Thank you. We're winding down. Bob, I'd like to give you some just quick closing comments and contact information for those that want to contact you about the photographer program, TIM.
Sure. I can be reached email rbowen, it's B-O-W-E-N, rbowen at antiochla.edu, antiochla.edu. And the last thing I'd like to say is just because some folks are homeless doesn't mean the rest of us need to be heartless.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Now, I'd like to extend a special thanks to my co-host, Ms. Earlene Anthony, and my in-studio guest, Mr. Bob Bowen, Andrea Ross, Kay Unsumi. Please listen to past shows of the Qumran Report on iTunes, Facebook, skidrow.la, and thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. And from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. And remember, if you get a chance, come out to the Vagina Monologues and help out on this fundraiser that they're having at the Vortex. It's a very important event, and it's going into a good cause, bringing attention to what's describing women's, what they're doing, the creative ability that we see in the downtown Skid Row area. Thank you very much. From your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I don't.
All right. Great.